Okay, so again, this is a makeup class. Read along is still section 37 to 38. Evaluation rate for now is 31 out of 92. You should evaluate the class. You should, you know, warn your future, you know, the future generation. And I remind you that Stokes' theorem, so I'm not sure, oh yes, they have an apostrophe over there, good, so I'm doing it right. So I remind you that Stokes' theorem says that if omega is a k minus 1 form on a compact orientable k manifold, then you've seen this identity, I will not say it again. And our goal for today is to continue the discussion of the three-dimensional cases, of which there are three. K can be 1, 2, or 3, right? Because k minus 1 better be non-negative. So k can be 1, 2, or 3 for this to make sense. So let's see what these cases are. And first, we studied the Dirac complex, which is a fancy name for the differential forms and the operator D, mapping k form to k plus 1 forms, and 0 forms were functions, 1 forms were vector fields, 2 forms were vector fields in a funny way, and 3 forms were functions back again, and the operator from functions to vector fields here corresponding to D was grad, here it was curl, and here it was div, and I want to see what is the Stokes theorem for grad, for curl, and for div. First, well, okay, so this is forms and div, but in Stokes' theorem, so there is forms and there is div, but there are also manifolds and integration. So I have to tell you what are manifolds in each case. Okay. In a zero-dimensional oriented manifold is simply a collection of points with signs. So it's basically you think of it as a union of pairs where each element in the pair, each pair is a point, is a sign and a point. And then the integration, so if you integrate a function on a manifold that looks like that, the result is simply the sum of the function at position at place pi taken with sign si. This we mentioned last time, and again it was a part of your homework assignment. Okay, in one dimension, in dimension 1, a manifold is just a curve in R3, or maybe a union of curves, or maybe a closed curve, so it could be a circle, but I'm just telling you what the generic situation is. So the generic thing is it's the image of a path, gamma, going from 0, 1 to R3. Okay? And then a two-dimensional manifold, again, a two-dimensional manifold could be complicated. It could be, a donut with 5 holes instead of 1. That's a fully legitimate two-dimensional surface, okay? And you can check that it's orientable. But still, at least locally, and that's all I will care about. I mean, this will be obtained by gluing together local pieces. So at least locally, it's the image of a map sigma from the two-dimensional disk into R3. And finally, a three-dimensional manifold in R3, again, it could be complicated. It could be sort of the inside of such a thing, right? The solid body whose boundary would be this, okay? Or it could be the shape of a human, okay? But I'll just think of it as a solid or a domain, D, inside R3. In fact, that would be a solid or a domain inside R3. I'm only stating the fact that it might be complicated. Okay. Now, what does integration mean in each of these cases? So, in the case of points, I already mentioned what is integration. In each of the other cases, you just have to follow the definitions and see what you get. So, what is integration in the one-dimensional case? So, suppose I have a vector field A, which is really a triple A1, A2, A3. So that would correspond to a differential form omega by the correspondence written over there, which is sum AI DXI. And suppose I wanted to integrate omega over a curve gamma, so over gamma, where gamma is given us here, so I don't have to copy it. So what is it? So by definition, this is the integral over the interval from 0 to 1 of the pullback via gamma of the form omega. Okay? And I think we did this already, but let's do it again nevertheless. Okay? So what's the pullback of omega? It's, so again, it's the interval in the integral from 0 to 1 of sum of ai times the pullback of xi. The pullback of xi is d, the pullback of xi. The pullback of xi is the ith component of gamma. So, in other words, if you write gamma as gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3, then here I have d of gamma I. Right? Because xi becomes gamma. And then, okay, and this is the integral from 0 to 1 of sum of ai, and of course when I say ai, I mean ai evaluated at gamma I, because that's the only thing that makes sense. So it's sum of ai, gamma I dot, the derivative of gamma I with respect to the parameter, let's say the parameter here is called t, times dt. And finally, this can be, wow, high tech, I raise one board and the other comes down by itself. So much better than the normal classroom. So, you know, the thing written here, well, sum of the components of one vector multiplied by the component of another vector is just the dot product of two vectors, the inner product of two vectors. So the thing written there is the integral of, so over 0, 1, of the inner product of the vector A, so with the vector gamma dot, okay? And it makes sense to write, so if we write gamma dot, so the derivative with respect to t of a curve is just the tangent to the curve, okay? But it makes sense to normalize it. So it makes sense to write it as the norm of gamma dot times a vector t, or sometimes t with an arrow on it, and t arrow is the unit tangent. So basically what I did is I decompose gamma dot into its length times a unit vector. So this is the unit tangent to gamma, to the curve gamma. So basically, the picture is, if this is gamma, then gamma dot might be longish, right? If the parametrization lowercase gamma runs through the curves, then the derivative will be high. Okay, so gamma dot might be long, so this might be gamma dot, and t will be of unit length. Alternatively, the parametrization might run very slowly through the curve, so it might be a turtle walking along the curve, and then the gamma dot will be very short, but still I'll keep t to be of unit size. Okay? And with this, this becomes the integral on 0, 1 of a dot t times gamma dot. But if you remember the definition of the volume element of, or the volume form for a k-dimensional surface, it had some determinant in it, but when you restrict it to the one-dimensional case, it simply becomes the length of the vector. So so this is the same as the integral of a dot, the tangent relative to the volume, where the volume is simply arc length when you talk about one-dimensional things. Okay? So integration here, you can interpret it in two ways. It's either the integral of a dot gamma dot, or it's the integral of a dot t relative to the volume. So, you know, from this perspective, what it means in practical terms is that you, at every point on the curve, so we have a vector field A in R3, so here is the vector field A. I'm drawing it in the plane, but I'm thinking of it in R3. In fact, it makes sense in Rn. Everything I did is not specific to R3. So we have a vector field on Rn, and we have a curve on Rn, and then at any point we take the dot product of the unit tangent to the curve. Now, the dot product of the, sorry, with the vector field. The dot product of the unit tangent with the vector field is simply the projection of the vector field to the, in the direction of the tangent. So it would be high for vectors that are tangent and small if a vector is perpendicular or zero. Okay? So we take this quantity and we integrate it along the curve, if you wish, by subdividing it into small pieces and taking each piece with its length, with a factor corresponding to its length. Okay, so that's what integration here means. Well, we already have one Stokes' theorem. Okay? And the one Stokes' theorem that we can write is the Stokes' theorem that lies in between these two. Right? So if a Stokes' theorem, or it lies between two columns of this picture, in a sense, in a way, because it relates k forms, k minus one forms with k forms. So we already have one Stokes' theorem, which we can put here, and since I don't have space, I'll call it theorem number one. So what's theorem number one? Okay, so theorem number one is, so I just copy. It's the integral, okay. So I'm assuming I am given a function f, right? So what's given in a, or what's the input to a Stokes equality? So a manifold of dimension k and a form of degree k minus 1. So if k is equal to 1, then what I'm given is a manifold of dimension k. So I'm given a curve gamma and a form of dimension of degree k minus 1, which means a function. So a function f. And then the Stokes theorem that we get is that the integral with Stokes here, the integral of the, over the manifold of d omega, so the integral over gamma of d omega, but d in our interpretation becomes grad. The vector field A that on which we integrate is grad. So we do, where is it? Also A over there becomes the gradient. So it's the integral of the gradient of F dot the tangent relative to the length, the arc length, is equal to the integral over the boundary. But the boundary of a curve, so if you have a curve gamma, the boundary is its head minus its tail. So you get f evaluated on gamma 1 minus f evaluated on gamma 0. And this is really a version of the fundamental theorem of calculus. In fact, it can be proven straight from the fundamental theorem of calculus by some change of variables. But what it says is, so if you think of f as elevation and gamma as describing a walk, then the elevation gain along a hike, so elevation gain along a hike, so this is the elevation at the end point minus the elevation at the beginning, is equal to, well, the integral of, so the gradient of f dot t, so the gradient of f is the vector describing the direction of the increase, right? If you have a, if f describes elevation, the gradient describes the direction to which f increases. And then f, and then this direction dot t is, to what extent do you walk in the direction of the increase? So it's precisely what's your local climb rate. So this is the integral of your local climb rate. And again, it completely makes sense. Okay. Well, we're not done, because we still have two more cases to study. We have to understand what is the integral on surfaces and what is the integral on solids. Okay, so next, so basically I want to repeat what I did now, but for the case of surfaces. So suppose, So I'm now here. Suppose I am given a vector field B, which is B1, B2, B3. What is the corresponding omega? What is the corresponding differential form? So the corresponding differential form, well, it's written here. It's B1 dx2 wedge dx3, and again, this is my short notation for it, plus cyclic permutations of this. So B2 dx, well, dx3 wedge dx1 plus B3 dx1 wedge dx2. Okay. Now I'm also given a surface S, and the question is, what is the integral over S of this omega? Right? This is what I'm trying to do right now. I'm trying to pair this surface with this form here. Okay? So, by definition, this is the integral over D2, so over the domain of the function sigma which parameterizes the surface, of sigma star of omega. Okay. Now, like before, sigma is really a triple of functions because it's valued in R3. So sigma is really a triple of functions, sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3. Before, I didn't bother to write what are the coordinates. The coordinate was t. Okay? Here, I will use coordinates x and y for the function. Okay? So, sigma 1 is a function of x and y, sigma 2 is a function of x and y, and sigma 3 is a function of x and y, and you can complain that this x interacts with this x. It doesn't really, because this is a single variable x, and this is an index x. So it should be easy to tell which is which. Okay. Right, so, I mean, this x is in the parameter space, and these x's are in R3. Okay. So what is this? Oh, I think I wanted to do it on the side. Rather than writing it as an integral, I wanted to compute the pullback. I wanted to compute this pullback on the side. So I'll go back to that formula in a minute. But for now, I just want to compute sigma star of omega, which means sigma star of some, no, let me write it without the sum. So B1 dx 2, 3 plus, sorry, no, let me write it in full, dx2 wedge dx3 plus cyclic permutations. Okay, you basically have to pull back everything. So you get B1, the pullback of B1 is B1 composed with sigma, but I'll just write it as B1 because that's the only thing that makes sense. It's B1 evaluated at sigma times dx2 means d sigma 2 wedge d sigma 3. Right? I believe. What is this? So this is B1 times, so d sigma 2 is d sigma 2 to dx 2 to dx times dx plus d sigma, sorry, I forgot here, plus cyclic permutations. Plus d sigma 2 to dy dy, and unfortunately, I still have to wedge it with the same thing with 3. So wedge d sigma 3 to dx dx plus d sigma 3 to dy dy, and again plus cyclic permutations. It's actually not too bad at the end of the day. So this is b1 times, okay, the result is going to be a two form on b2, which is two dimensional. So it must be proportional to dx wedge dy. And indeed, the only thing you get here is dx's and dy's. So the result is proportional to dx wedge dy. And the only thing that matters is what is the constant of proportionality. The constant of proportionality, well, you get a term proportional to dx with dy in two ways. Either by taking this times this, so d sigma 2 to d x times d sigma 3 to dy, and I clearly didn't leave enough space, or by taking the dy from here and the dx from here. The other two terms are zero because they have a repeating form. So here you will get, well, okay, but here you get the dy and the dx in the wrong order. So you get a minus d sigma 2 to dy times d sigma 3 to dx. And I think I regret the order by which I wrote these terms. Do I regret? I regret the order by which I wrote these terms, so let me swap them. So let me make it sigma 3 to dx and sigma 2 to dy. Okay? So all of this times dx wedge dy, and all of this, you have to add cyclic permutations. Okay. But if you look at this, you should recognize it. It should look a little bit like a piece of a vector product. And indeed, if you look at it a little bit longer, it does look like a piece of a vector product. So, precisely, you can rewrite this as b1 times, you look at the vector, the derivative of sigma with respect to x. So sigma is a triple of functions. So if you take its derivative, you get a triple of derivatives. So you get a vector. And you cross this vector with d sigma to dy. And then simply if you, sorry, the result is a vector. But if you look at the first components of that vector, it's exactly that. So basically, this is just d sigma 1 to dx, d sigma 2 to dx, d sigma 3 to dx. Likewise, this is the same thing, but with dy everywhere. And when you compute the cross product, you simply get this formula. Okay? Plus cyclic permutations. But by now, cyclic permutation just means that we, right, the only thing being permuted, the only index that appears here is this index 1. In the next term, it will become 2, and in the next, and the last term, it will become 3. So this is really sum of bi times d sigma to dx cross d sigma to dy, the i-th coordinate. And finally, and I forgot the dx wedge dy everywhere. Sorry, so all of this multiplying dx wedge dy, and this is again multiplying dx wedge dy. Okay, and this is just the inner product of the vector b, right? The sum of the I coordinate of one vector with the I coordinate of another vector is just the inner product. So this is the inner product of the vector b with the cross product of d sigma dx with d sigma dy. Okay, dx wedge dy. And why is this? So I'm running out of space. And I really don't want to, I'm sorry, I'll just use the, this space here. So you may remember that the cross product of two vectors, so if you have v1 cross v2, in general, what is the, do you have a geometric meaning for the cross product of two vectors?
Orientable.
What?
Orientable. So it's a volume made.
Right. It's the volume of the parallelogram spanned by these two vectors, but taken in the direction which is normal to these two vectors. Okay? So this is V, the volume generated by the vectors V1, V2, times N, where N is the unit normal to, so it's the vector of unit length which is normal to V1 and V2. So basically, if you take the vector product of two vectors, here are the two vectors, the result is the vector which is normal to both of them and has length one, and has length which is the volume of the parallelogram these two vectors generate. Okay? So the thing written over there, so if I am to continue the equality from over there, so this becomes B dot the normal vector to, okay, what's the normal vector to d sigma x, d sigma to dx and d sigma to dy? So, d sigma to dx is a vector tangent to our surface, right? So we have a two-dimensional surface, right? We have a two-dimensional surface, and we are at some point, and we're differentiating the function sigma, which parameterizes the surface, first in the x direction and then in the y direction. So d sigma dx is a vector tangent to the surface, and d sigma dy is another vector tangent to the surface. Alternatively, if you wish, these are the push forwards or d sigma to dx and d sigma to dy are the push forwards of the standard E1 and E2 using sigma. So they're, by definition, the two tangents. So this is the normal, the unit normal to S, to the surface. I didn't finish copying the formula, so times the volume generated by these two tangents, so d sigma to dx and d sigma to dy times dx wedged dy. And okay, all of this was a lengthy computation of the pullback of omega via sigma. So now I can just continue this line. This becomes the integral over d2 of this quantity. So b dot n times this volume of d sigma to dx, d sigma to dy, but multiplying or integrating when you multiply by the volume is what we call the integration relative to the volume. So this is the integral over S of B dot N. And that's all. So the conclusion is that this, the integral here, becomes the integral over the surface of the vector field B dotted with N. How should you view it? Okay? What does this measure? So I have a flow in R3, right? B is a vector field. So it might represent a flow. So I have a flow in R3, well, here, around us, and I have a surface in R3. Here is the surface. The surface at any point has a normal. So think of a kind of spiky hair pointing out of the surface, okay? And then at every point of the surface, you take the component of the vector which is in the direction of the normal, because that's what dot product measures. It's the component of B in the direction of N. So basically, if the vector field is parallel to the surface, you take zero. If the vector field is perpendicular to the surface, you just get the size, the length of the vector field. So really, you're measuring how much of the flow flows through the surface. Okay? Flows perpendicular to the surface, which means through the surface, across the surface. So this really measures the flow of B through S. Okay? And again, we have a Stokes' theorem. So there is a Stokes theorem relating these two, and it's theorem number 2. So I can write it on this blackboard. So I have two. So here K is equal to 2. I am given a surface S and a vector field. What should I call it? What? No. I should call it A, not B. Right? Stokes' theorem, I've erased it right now. Oh, but it's still here. It relates K minus 1 forms with K-dimensional manifolds. So I should be using a k minus 1 form here. So a k minus 1 form where k is equal to 2 is a 1 form. A 1 form in the language that we used here is living here, and the corresponding vector field should be A. So if I want to use the same naming convention, I should be using the vector field A. And then Stokes' theorem, well, let me remind you what it is. It's the integral over the surface of, it's the integral over the surface of d omega is equal to the integral over the boundary of the surface of omega. So what is it? No, sorry, I still want to do it in the, well, you know what, all I want is to center it. Sorry. So the integral over the surface of d omega is equal to integral over the boundary of the surface of omega. So let's interpret both sides. So this is a surface with boundary. So it might look like, something like that. Okay? So this is the surface S, this is the boundary of S. So the d omega becomes the form corresponding to curl of A. So I should be taking this formula and replacing B by curl of A. So this should be the integral over the surface of the curl of A dot the normal relative to, I forgot to put here relative to volume. So relative to the volume. And on the right hand side, this is just a path integral, or it's an integral along the curve. So it's still the integral along S of A dot dv. Okay. Right. Okay. What does it mean geometrically? So this one is the hardest of the three to visualize. So I still have a flow in R3, but this flow is A, and I want to remember what curl of A measures. So if you remember, the curl of A measures basically how much the flow tends to spin, or how much it spins objects. Basically you throw a ball into the flow and you see how much it rotates, and it rotates in an axis, and curl has magnitude, which is to sort of equal to the speed of rotation, and direction, which is equal to the axis of rotation. Okay? So now, what I do is I integrate the curl of A dot the normal to the surface. So I have my surface. The normal is again pointing outward at any, or pointing perpendicular to the surface at any point. And I'm integrating the component of the curl, which is in the direction of the normal. So you think of the surface as having, as decomposed into lots and lots and lots of balls, or lots and lots of small, what should we call it, styrofoam, you know, this little packaging material, right? This is sort of white styrofoam balls. You know what I'm talking about? So think of making the surface out of that and let the water flow. But you know, constrain those little balls so that they don't move out of the surface. So each of them will tend to spin, but I measure only the direction, sorry, only the part of the spinning whose axis is perpendicular to the surface. So basically, I'm measuring, so again, I don't know where to put it. So here is my surface. I put lots and lots and lots of these styrofoam balls in it, and I measure how much each of them spins. So I let water flow through this surface or around this surface using flow specified by A, and I measure how much each of them spins in the direction so that the axis is perpendicular to the surface, which just means that I measure the spinning in the plane of the surface. So I measure how much each of them spins kind of in the plane of the surface. So that's the left, and then I total this over all of these balls. So that's the left-hand side. The right-hand side is easier. The right-hand side is basically you look at the vector field A, and you see how much of it flows parallel to the boundary, right? That's exactly what this measures. You integrate over the full boundary how much of the vector field is in the direction parallel to the boundary. So the claim that is made here is that the total spinning of all of these balls is equal to the circulation of the flow around the boundary. Okay? Now, I don't know, you don't have to buy it, but we've proven it. Okay, all right, that's a statement of, that's a part of Stokes' theorem. So somehow it's a local spinning of in the plane of the surface in the plane of S when integrated over S gives circulation of A along the boundary of S. And that's the hardest case, and we run out of time, so the remaining case will have to happen tomorrow. Okay. So see you tomorrow.